Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to the computational physics course. Today we have to do a bit of administrative things before I start with the class. So let's get started with that. We are going to use web pages hosted on GitHub to communicate about the course and for me to send out notes and announcements. And also if you have questions or issues regarding the course, I want you to go to GitHub and open an issue there to communicate with me. The reason is not that I like GitHub, but that computational physics is not just about programming and numbers. It's also about project management and producing reproducible science, etc. And part of that workflow is using a source code repository and maybe communicating in open source projects with friends and collaborators. And this is such a repository, and this will give you a feeling for how to do that. If you take the course for credit, I will also expect you to produce such an open source project as first mini project for this Julia course. Let me briefly switch to a web browser that has these websites open. If that works, hello. There you go. And then we can go through some of the details. So this is a GitHub repository. Is that large enough? Let me increase the font size a bit. If you have never used GitHub before, I want you to go there and ask for an account, open an account there. That will allow you to submit issues. If you have an issue with the course, you can go here, click on issues, and then create a new issue. And what kind of issue should we do? Anybody has an idea? This is the first issue. And then you type something in here. I have no complaints. And then you submit the issue. And this will then send me an email. And if you are registered for the course, so if you're watching the repository, here's a watch button, an unwatch button, since I'm already watching it, you will also get an issue about that. Note the repository is completely public. It means in principle there are 7 billion people who can contribute to the course. But this is like a needle in a haystack. Not too many people know about this, so I'm not actually worried about spam. Hey, there you go. Thank you. Yes, you can also comment about issues. Let's go back to the actually wiki of the course. I think you should be able to edit the wiki. If not, I can give you permission to edit the wiki. And if you want to collect notes about the course and share them with your colleagues, we can also use that repository for that. I can give you write permission for the wiki if you let me know your GitHub user IDs. So this is the usual thing: course outline, time and date, when we meet. We meet Wednesdays 1 to 2, Fridays 1 to 3. And if you're taking the course for credit, which most of you won't, then you should talk to me on Friday after the course to discuss some details. Since most of you are just auditing the course and not interested in credits, I don't want to discuss it at the moment. That would just bore most people. And here's a planned schedule that can still change for the first module. That is me introducing the programming language Julia. And there will be other modules taught by Luis Lena, Guy Vidal, and Dustin Lang. And they have not set up a schedule yet, mostly because, and that is always the largest issue when teaching a computational physics course, I have no idea what your backgrounds are. Is this the first time you're actually programming? Or do you know programming already and you're just interested in learning more details about numerical relativity? So there's going to be a questionnaire for me and for us instructors to learn more about what you already know, and we can tailor the course for that. I think we've talked about everything on the website. If there's anything else, open an issue and I'll add the information to the wiki. I mentioned this. If you take the course for credit, please talk to me Friday at 3 after the course, that we can discuss the details for how you get credit, what mini projects I expect, and what kind of teamwork would be acceptable and would be not. So I do allow teamwork because science is always done in a collaboration, but I still need to be able to find out who did what in a particular team. Now, to learn more about what background you have and what you already know in terms of computational science or in terms of programming, I want you to go to this questionnaire and fill it in. And I want you to do it now. If you have a laptop, I didn't ask for a laptop. Sorry, if you don't have a laptop or a phone, then obviously you can't do it now. Please do it later. But otherwise, do it now. I'll just wait for 2 minutes because it shouldn't take too long. It's just a rather simple questionnaire. Let me open it here. Yeah, let me make that a bit larger. You can see the link. In the questionnaire, the first 3, 4, or 5 questions are about the experience that you have in terms of programming, in terms of Julia. And the last 2 questions are voluntary. These are statistics that the administrators are going to ask me later. They're going to find out how many undergrad and graduate students attended the course, etc. Okay, I'll give you another 10 seconds, and I'm going to ask whether you're finished to see how far you've proceeded. Let me reload that page here. Maybe it tells me how many results there are. Does it? Oh, no, I need to log in. Yeah, no, I'm not going to do that. Sorry. Let's go back to this one here. Then at least you have the URL that you can see. Okay, who has finished the questionnaire so far? Most of you? Yeah. Let's wait a few more seconds and you can finish filling it in later. You can even change your answers later because it's not anything relevant. Yes?
Is there any password for the Wi-Fi?
Here at Perimeter, we have EduRoam. So if you have
I don't have an EduRoam, so.
Okay. We should talk about it later. Can you talk to me after the course? We can set up something. There's something for guests and visitors, but in principle, EduRoam is the way to go at Perimeter. Okay, let me assume you filled in the questionnaire, and let me assume there's actually a reasonable distribution of what you know and what you don't know. I'll find that out later. So let's get to the last slide of this administrative task, and that is, why am I using the language Julia for a computational physics course? Why not some other language? And there are hundreds of other languages to choose from, so this is always a question that people ask. And the most important answer is, of course, it doesn't matter in which language the course is taught, because computational physics isn't about a particular language. It's about methods and algorithms and thinking in a particular way. And 10 years ago, the language would probably have been C. 20 years ago, it would have been Fortran. 5 years ago, Python. Today, you can still talk and teach in Python. And 10 years from now, who knows what happens? So in your career, you're going to have to learn multiple languages. And for this particular course, I think Julia is the best language. Not because Julia is the best language, just because given the goals of this course. And the reason is Julia has, compared to Python, a strong type system, and that has 2 advantages. First advantage is that types are like constraints. They help prevent errors. They make programming easier. They catch errors earlier. And the other thing is that these constraints also help the compiler produce more efficient code. That means it makes it easier to write fast, efficient programs in Julia than in other languages. I might be talking more about that later on in the lecture, or might not, depending on your interest. At the moment, I want to keep it like that. We're going to use version 1.0 of the language. And if you go to julialang.org, you'll see the language described there. And you will all need to have access to a Julia installation somewhere. You all need to have either a laptop or some other method of interacting with the language. And we're going to do that on Friday. For those of you who have not used Julia yet, this is going to be a 2-hour lab where we help you install Julia on your laptop and take the first steps in Julia, run a small program that you're all familiar with it. This is always a bit tedious in a computational science course because some people already know Julia, then you might not even want to show up on Friday. And for some people, it's problematic, in particular, if you have some weird Linux laptop where it's always difficult to install software. And finally, if you want to have a more in-depth introduction to Julia, to the language or a tutorial or something that I'm not covering here in the lecture, there's always YouTube. There was a JuliaCon, a Julia conference in beginning of August this year, JuliaCon 2018. If you look for that on the Julia Lang website or on YouTube, then you're easily going to find tutorials that you can watch online. And most of these are, well, at least as interesting as this lecture here, and you can learn more there. This concludes the administrative part of this first lecture here. Do you have further questions? Yes?
Will the slides be uploaded to the course website?
A good point. Yes, of course, I will do that as PDF. And if I forget, please remind me by opening an issue. Yes. I'm going to upload it to the repository, and you should be able to just click on it somewhere on the web. Also, if one of you wants to keep notes of the course, notes for yourself, you can also upload the notes somewhere on the wiki, on the repository. That might also help others. I'm not asking you to do that, but sometimes you'll find it useful. And given the format that I'm choosing for the lecture, that might actually be interesting. You have further questions? Okay, then let's switch over to me introducing the language Julia. I decided I will not be preparing slides or anything like that, because if I prepare slides, that is very convenient for the audience. You can just sit back and relax, and that is not what I want. Rather, I'm going to do some interactive programming that worked quite well when teaching psych courses here in Mathematica. And that means I'm going to do some live coding, simple examples. I'm going to explain the concepts that I'm presenting here. And that should make it exciting for you, because I hope you will catch me making errors. And if you have a particular question or a concern, then of course I can tend to that right away. So let me switch to a particular terminal. And is that large enough? No, it's never large enough. Let me get it a bit larger. Can you all see that? Wait, people can never see the bottom of the screen. Is that good like that? Can you see that? Let me type Julia here. Is that visible? Okay, let me walk to the back of the room and actually see whether it works, because people never complain.
It's the usual problem with bright green, you can't see it.
Yeah, I don't like the green either. I opened an issue with that, actually, but it hasn't been fixed yet, so I tried to fix it myself. It's more difficult than I thought, so I haven't been able to fix it yet. Okay, so I'm going to use a terminal and run Julia in a terminal here. I'm going to type expression and Julia responds right away. That's a similar way you would do it in Mathematica or a Maple. There you have a graphical user interface. Here it's not quite graphical. Julia is a language, and if you type something in there, you get a result. For example, if you type 2 plus 3, the result obviously is going to be 5. If you calculate the square root of a certain number, then you get the result as well. And as usual, Julia uses double precision, gives you about 15 different digits. Nothing fancy about that. Every value in Julia has a type, and you can ask what the type is with a function type of. So type of the number 2, it's a 64-bit integer. Type of the number 2.0, it's a 64-bit floating point number. So 2 and 2.0 are different numbers, they're different types. And you can type of the string ABC, which is a string, and type of a character A is a character. Nothing special here. Julia also has arrays, so you can write 1, 2, 3. If you know Python, that should be familiar to you. In Mathematica, you'd use the curly braces. Here's the square brackets. This is a 3-element array with the elements 1, 2, 3. You can also have 2-dimensional arrays. This is just a whirlwind introduction that I'm giving to you. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is the 2-dimensional arrays with the elements 1, 2, 3, and 4. You have the usual operations. You can add things, for example, 1 plus 2. You can add arrays. 1, 2 plus 3, 4 is element-wise addition. And you can also multiply arrays. Is this going to work? By default, this is not going to work, because if you multiply arrays, there are different ways of doing that, right? You can have something like a dot product that measures things together. You can have a tensor product that would give a two-dimensional array, or an element-wise operation. So I think this is undefined. Yes, oof. Wow, yeah, this is very eager to give me an error message here. Yeah. So it's undefined, no matching method. I didn't expect such an error message. Wow, okay. And what you can do is an element-wise operation. If you add a dot in front of an operator, that applies a function element-wise. So this is element-wise multiplication, which should lead to 3,8. And you can also calculate something like the sine of the array 1 and 2, which of course is also not defined. Yeah, better error message here. And you can also do an element-wise operation on the array that gives you this output here, with this particular dot syntax. Okay, I have some notes here of things I wanted to cover. You can also have operations like the sum or the maximum of an array. For example, the sum of the element 1 and 2, 3, the maximum is 2. Yeah, so these are the kind of errors that you make. If you have, let's define a variable. I like to define array variables with a plural. The plural of x is x's or something. Is 1 to 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then you can get the fourth element, which is 4. And you can get the fourth element to the sixth element, which is an array. Or you can go for the fourth element to the end, or from the first element to the second element. Or you can go for the first element to the second element, which is an empty array, a zero element array that you get here. You can also loop over arrays. For example, for I in 1.10, print line xs of I, and there's loops over the whole array, and for each array element, it outputs something to the screen. So you get the numbers from 1 to 10. And there is an array comprehension syntax where you can define a new array based on an operation that you apply to an old array. Let me give you an example here. For example, x squared for x in x's. This loops over the array x's, assigns in turn each element to the variable x and calculates x squared, and this is result is then stored in the element y's. So these are then the numbers from 1 to 100. So what I'm introducing here is this array comprehension syntax. In addition to arrays, arrays are a basic data structure because they're very efficient, and for numerical programming, as introduced by Fortran, they're a really important data type. Of course, they're not always convenient because you have this discontinuous integer range to which you need to assign something. Julia also has sets, so I think you just write set 1, 2, 3. This is the set of the numbers 1, 2, 3, and as you see internally, there's no particular order that's respected by the set, but of course, if you have one element multiple times, the set will be normalized. And once you have sets, I'm not showing you that. Of course, they have the union, the intersection, the symmetric difference, and all the different things that you can do. You can also loop over each element in a set. And Julia also has dictionaries. And dictionaries are something like lookup tables. You might know them from Python. And I think you create them like this. So A, let's map it to 1, and B, let's map it to 2. And Q, let's map it to, can you give me a number here? 100. What did you say?
100.
Thank you. And this is a dictionary. Let's assign it to something. Let's call it D. And then we look what D of A means. It is 1. And D of B is 2. And D of C is not defined because the corresponding key does not exist. And depending on what you want to handle, you might need an array or a set or a dictionary, and these are most of the data structures that you need in programming. You can also ask, you can, for example, is the element A in D? Is A one of the keys of the element D? Sorry, I need to be more exact here. Yes, and if you ask it for C, that is then false. So this can help you avoid the error message. I don't want to introduce too many concepts here that might be confusing, but the concept of equality and what is a value and what's an object is actually quite fundamental. So for example, if I ask whether the one number one is equal to the number one, you need to use two equal signs. One equal sign is an assignment. The answer is true. And if you ask whether 1 is equal to 2, the answer is false. This is kind of the mathematical notation for equality. But what also happens is that you can create certain objects in memory, and these objects have an identity. Let's, for example, create an array access and assign it 1, 2, 3. And let's define another array wise that is also 1, 2, 3. And then the question is, are they identical or are they not identical? So we can ask whether they are identical. And the answer is yes, they're identical in the sense they contain the same elements, but they're actually stored as two different objects in memory. So we can use three equal signs. That means whether they are kind of the same object, and you will find out they are not, and access equals to access is actually true. So I don't find the good way to explain that, because mathematically they are identical. So what I'm introducing here is a concept where software engineering deviates from mathematics in a certain way to make it confusing. If you want to store an array, then what happens internally that a certain region of the memory is set aside to hold the values that are stored in the array. And if you create a new array, then a second region of memory will be allocated. And even if that second region contains the same data as the first region, it's still two different regions of memory. And in Julia, it's possible to distinguish between that. I'm going to go into more detail in a bit. Your question?
If I let alpha equals to x, is x is 3?
Okay, we can assign z as equals access. That means we take access and assign it to Z's, and now we still have two regions of memory because we have not made a copy of access. So if we then ask whether access is equals to Z's, it's yes, and Z's of course is not equal to Y's. And we can also make a copy of it. For example, W is equal copy of access, and then we can ask whether they are identical. They are not identical because now we made a copy. Yes? Yes, you had a question.
For example, now you were saying that Z of the first element is 3.
Yes.
It will modify also XS, right?
Okay. Yeah, I'm not talking about modification yet, but maybe that's a good point. If you have an array, you can actually modify it. So let's look at the first element of XS. It's 1, and we can assign a different value to it. XS 1, for example, let's set it to minus 1. Now, if you look at access, you see it's minus 1, 2, 3. Then we have y's. That was a different array. That is unchanged. Let's look at z's. Z's and x's were identical objects. So if you change one of them, you change the other of them as well. It's like you have a box in memory that contains the values, and we have two labels on the box, x's and y's. And if you look at w's, where we made a copy, then of course it's the original thing as well. And this is quite confusing. The mathematical semantics is also called value semantics. That means the identity of an object is just the value that it has. If it's the same value, it's the same object. If it's a different value, it's a different object. This is the thing that holds in mathematics. It's very elegant, very powerful. Whereas the other semantics that you have is more procedural. It has to do with assignment and mutation, and it's more difficult to get it right. Yes?
So what's the equivalent of a worksheet with this thing? Because I don't want to go typing stuff in every time. I'm sure that isn't how you do it. Something like maybe where you open a worksheet and you type stuff and you run it and it will run the whole thing.
Okay, I didn't understand the question. Was that a suggestion for me to change the way I show the code here?
I'm just wondering the sort of basic file handling in this thing. When you show me a bunch of types, and that's very useful. But I would like to know the sort of file handling of, I want to create a program, I want to have a file, presumably which has some...
Oh yes, I'm going to go to that. At the moment I'm showing you the interactive things, because this allows you to do the first steps of the language. Later on, it's going to get more complicated, there's going to be code written in an editor, and you can load that code and run it, and then you just modify it, then you don't do it interactively. These are just the first steps to get the language, to know the language. Definitely. Yes?
Just a quick question. Is this similar to the idea of pointers in Java?
Yes. It is similar to pointers or references or whatever it is called. Okay. So this was a basic introduction to the syntax of the language, to some of the basic types that exist, and the idea of mutability. And what I want to do next is introduce in more detail the type system of Julia. I think in this lecture, I'm going to compare Julia and Python as languages, because Python is the obvious scientific computing language, introductory scientific computing language these days, and I'm kind of deviating from the main track by using Julia. So I'm comparing, because I assume if you know a language, it could be Python. So Julia has a type system. So I said every object has a type. For example, 2 has a type. The type of 2 is int64. int64 is again an object of the language. So if I type int64, it's not an error, because the language cannot talk about values, it can also talk about the types. I said everything has a type, so int64 also has a type. We can ask of the type of int64. And the type is data type. It is a data type.
What's the type of data type?
Yeah, that's the problem with doing this. I don't know. It's probably data type. Yes. So data types are also there, right? They close the loop after one iteration. Now, there's also a type hierarchy in Julia. It's single inheritance. It's not as complicated as C++, but you can ask for the supertype of a type. So supertype of int64, signed, as in signed integers. The supertype of signed integers is integer. The supertype of integer is real. The rabbit hole goes deep. The supertype of number is any. And the supertype of any is any again. So that's where I stop. So any is a supertype of all the types that exist in Julia. Yes?
So can you do int32, int16?
Yes, yes, you can. For example, you can also talk of the subtypes signed, and this showed you all the signed integer types that there exist, and this is just what you suggest, int 128, they have about 40 digits, I think, to int 8 down here, and there's also a big int that's an arbitrary integer with arbitrary many types. So 10, type of 10 is 10, you can write big 10, that gives you a big integer, it has a type of big int. And if you're a big 10 to the thousands power or something, you get 1,000 zeros on the screen. Or you can get 1,000,000 zeros. That, of course, works as well, because 1,000,000 is not actually a big number these days. Yes?
So how is the int 128 implemented?
So Julia is implemented based on LLVM, the compiler infrastructure, and that provides arbitrary precision integers. So the arithmetic that is offered by the CPU here goes to 64 bits, and then the algorithms to do whatever you add, you need to keep track of the carry. If you multiply, you need to do the whatever long multiplication, long division. These algorithms are implemented in the compiler, and Julia just uses that. So it didn't actually need to implement that.
Would it be much less efficient to work with a data type like that?
No, I think int 128 is probably 2 or 4 times as slow, I mean, it takes 4 times longer than in 64. It's not that bad. Multiplication is bad because division is bad because you do long division, you also need to go through it. Regular things are not so difficult. There are complex numbers, of course. You can write 1 plus 2m. So the imaginary unit is called im, as in imaginary, because the letter I is often used for variables. And let's look at the type of that. This is a complexified integer type. Of course, you can also have complexified real types and so on. And go ahead. Yes?
So just about the integers, if you don't assign like big int or int 26, does Julia automatically assign int 64 to all integers, integer variables as a type?
So values have types. So if you type something like 12, it's going to be an int64. If you have a 32-bit operating system, it's going to be a 32-bit integer. And if you type something like 1.2, then it's going to be a float 64 everywhere. That's what it's signed. But if you have a variable, and if you write something like x equals 12, then there is not really a type assigned to a variable. The value has a type, and the variable just holds that. If I type something here in the command line, there's nothing you can do about that. if you write a function or something more complicated, then you can also put a constraint on the kind of values that you can put into a value. Let's do that, right? Let's write a function, function f, and let's say x, and x should be an int in 64, and let's rect equals 1, and let's return x from the function. Then if we call f, yeah, sorry, no, that didn't work, wrong syntax. I hope I'm getting the function declaration syntax right here. If not, someone who knows Julia can help me out. Yes, this is this. Come on, I want to scroll up, yes. Now the network is out, very good. And if I were to assign 1.0 to the variable, this would lead to an error, I hope. Because I said x needs to be of the value in 64, I can't assign the floating point number to it. Okay, I don't understand what's going on here. Apparently what Julia does, it looks at the variable, it deduces I'm assigning a floating point number to it, and that's what it goes with.
Try 1.2.
Oh, very good. Yes. Oh, yes, very good. What I just said was wrong. Very good, thank you. So what happens is that I said the variable can only, what I declare, the variable can only hold integers. Then I try to assign the floating point value 1.0 to it. And then Julia takes this floating point value 1.0 and converts it to integer. And if that is possible without loss of accuracy, then it's done silently. And so x contains the value 1, but as integer, as declared. And the value 1.0 cannot be converted to integer without loss of accuracy. You'd have to round. And this leads to the error message here. Convert, inexact error, because 1.0 cannot be converted to integer. Very good. I knew that. Well, apparently not well enough. Yes?
Just quickly. So you mentioned before that the variable x would not normally have type associated with it, but in this case, now it does have a type.
Yes. So with not a type, I mean the type any. This is associated with a variable as kind of a constraint, what can be stored and what not. But for example, if you say that type x can contain any value, that means as soon as a particular value is stored into it, that value does have a concrete type. But the type is associated with the value. The variable is just the box. And depending on what you allow to be put in the box and what not, the code could be more or less efficient, but you can be generic there.
And so you can use the supertypes as well? Or complex?
Yes, you can do that as well. So if I say x is real and I assign 1.2 to it and I run it, then the result is 1.2. You see it has a dot, so it's a real number. If I assign 1.0, it's still a real number because it's still output with a dot. And this is now 1, an integer, no dot. And of course, you can still make the code go wrong because characters cannot be converted to any. And okay, yes, characters can be converted to unsigned integers. Unsigned integers are subtypes of real numbers, so this is what happens here. Yeah, that. So it's good that I fail here because that means in real-world programs, people make the same kind of mistakes. And that also tells you, although I consider myself to be a very experienced programmer, I still make stupid mistakes like that, so there's nothing wrong with that. Okay, very good. Yes?
Well, maybe it's expecting something that's not base 10 and it passes it as x?
No. 6.1 is the ASCII code for the lowercase letter a. So I think it's 97 or 93 or something, and that's what that is. We can take that value and convert it to an integer. So this is an unsigned integer, which is why it's output with the 0x syntax, and as integer, it's 97. Yeah. So no, it does not actually parse strings. If you want to convert to a string to an integer, then... So if I write whatever 1, 2, 3, that's a string. That's not a number. You cannot write 1, 2, 3 plus 1. That doesn't work. But you can parse it as an integer. That's a slow thing because it needs to look at all the digits and so on. And then you get the integer out, which you can add. But parsing always needs to be explicit. There are some other languages that would automatically parse or not, but luckily Julia does not do that.
Right. Can you set up a type so that it will accept something like hex?
Like hex?
Right. Instead of having base 10, it's base 16.
Yeah, you can write 0x in front of it. Or you can also, there's also a particular syntax where you do that. You can kind of extend the language with arbitrary parsers. Then for the Julia parser, it looks like a string. And then after reading that string, it runs your parsing routine and then converts the string as doing something else. And it does it not at runtime, but as part of compiling the function. It's very advanced. I never used it myself, but it's in the documentation. So that's possible if you want to do that. OK. So we're still working at talking about types. So there are also tuples that you can write. For example, 1a is a tuple. You can also look at the type of that tuple, which is a tuple of an integer and a character. And tuples can have arbitrary length. There is a zero length tuple. There are tuples with one element. They look a bit strange because you need to have a trailing comma without anything there. Or you can have tuple with many different numbers or characters. Or you can put an array in a tuple if you want. As long as you want. It's quite convenient. And you can also have union types. So you can write union of int and character. This is a new type. And if you declare a variable of this type, then it can also either hold a character or an integer. And of course, at runtime, you can query what the type is to find out whether it stores a character or an integer. And yeah, since we're talking about the type, there's a cool thing. If you write backslash and then a Greek letter, and then you hit the tab key, you get the corresponding letter. Looks nice. Pi is, of course, this. And you convert pi to 64-bit integer. Then you get 15 digits. And if you convert pi to big float, then you get probably about 80 digits or something. I think it's 256 bit. And if you have a big float number, you can choose how many bits you want to represent something. So if you want to do a calculation with a million bits of floating point position, you can do that. Or of course, you could use rational numbers. If you write 1 over 2, then you get the float 64 number. And hello? Sorry, on my screen it looked normal. I don't know what that was. So if you write 1 divided by 2, that gives you a floating point number. And if you double this, then you get a rational number. And of course, rational numbers don't lose any precision. So if you write 1, 2, 10 to the 10, does this work? Yeah. Plus 1 divided by 10 to the 10 plus 1, then outcome. Close it. By default, it uses 64-bit integers. If you add a few bigs in there, then you lose this arbitrary precision integers, and then you don't get an overflow. And then this is the corresponding result. So rational numbers are quite convenient. So I'm sometimes using codes where I use polynomials to represent something. And of course, if you evaluate polynomials with floating point numbers, they're always a bit inaccurate. You never quite know whether it works. And a rather cool trick is to just use rational numbers with arbitrary precision. And then you can invert every invertible matrix, and there is no point of floating point error and so on. I mean, it's not really fast, right? You don't want to do it with a big 1,000 by 1,000 matrix. But for testing code, 5 by 5 matrix and so on, it works quite nicely. And with floating point numbers, you never quite know whether something is exact or not. That's good. Yes?
What is the type of pi by default?
Haha. You can write pi also like that if you want. It's irrational. So this is a special built-in type into Julia, a special type that is declared for irrational numbers. There is another for is it called Euler? I think you can write backslash Euler. How does it work? Yeah. And this is also something. And what happens is that as Julia decides what method to call. So if you just have this irrational number, it's kept as this irrational number. It is just the type tag, so to say. And if you add it to a floating point number, then this irrational number will be approximated by a floating point number, and then you do floating point approximation. So if you add pi to a 32-bit floating point number, it will get the 32-bit approximation. And if you add pi to another floating point approximation that has 1,000 bits, then the corresponding approximation will be generated. So it's as accurate as it can be. Yes.
Take the square root of 2, does it turn into float or irrational?
That turns into float right away. Yes, it doesn't do that. Now, you could define your own irrational number for the square root of 2 and do that, but you have to kind of do that for all irrational numbers manually for everyone, so you can't keep that. What you're asking for is something like symbolic evaluation, and that's not really built into Julia. I mean, you can build it into the language. In principle, it's as powerful as Mathematica, but since the focus of the language is elsewhere, there are a few add-on packages that allow symbolic manipulation, but it's kind of half-hearted compared to Mathematica. Begin rational. Okay, I did not talk about how functions or expressions are evaluated. What happens is that when a function is called, it is actually compiled to very efficient machine code, and then the function is executed. That means the first time a function is called, it is really slow. It can take many, many milliseconds to call a function. That also means if you start Julia, it kind of takes a second because it needs to compile many functions as you start up. But later on, if you call the function a million times, then a million times you get something very efficient. That is also different for most interpreted languages. And you can actually look at how the machine code looks for a particular function. Let's define a function, for example, f of x, y, z equals x times y plus z or something, minus 42. And then you can look at code native of f of 1, 2, 3. And that should, if everything goes well, show you the machine code that is generated for this. And there you go. As you see, machine code is difficult to read. I have a passing knowledge of it, but you can look at these things. There's, for example, here that something that is imul, that is an integer multiplication. And here is an load defective address that is essentially an addition. There's another addition here where you add the number minus 42 and then the function returns. So this function, if you call it for integers, compiles to essentially three machine instructions. And a machine instruction takes about 0.3 nanoseconds to execute or something. So that is sufficient. If you call this function with floating point numbers, say 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, then it is compiled again. So there are two methods for this function, for the different types, and this is where this type information gives you the added performance, because this is now a different compiled function when you see different machine instructions. Here you have another mul, this is now a floating point multiplication, here's another addition, then you have a move, this number here is apparently minus 42 as a floating point number, that is whatever format floating point numbers have, and then another addition, and then return. So this one, as floating point numbers, turns into 5 floating point instructions, also quite efficient.
So I noticed it uses these vector registers. How come
yes.
it does that by default when that's not necessarily?
This is the most efficient way of doing addition and multiplication. So this is not a choice that Julia makes, but rather when Julia starts up, it looks at on what hardware it is running, and then configures LLVM, the compiler, to produce the most efficient code for that hardware. And this is then, the actual instructions are then chosen by this compiler framework. And you see this S in here, and this S means scalar. So although it's a vector instruction that can do vector operation, this operation just acts on a scalar on a single number. And there's the suffix D here, that means it's a double position number.
So are all variables in the function implicitly local? I mean, there are local variables that would not interact with other things that you...
By default, variables are local variables. Yeah, so I defined the function like this. We can also... define it like this. This is just a longer way. Instead of assigning something, you write something and then an end. And then let's write a temporary, for example, you write a equals x times y, b equals a plus z, and then return b minus 42, end of the function. And this would be the same function. We have introduced here two local variables, a and b. The types of the local variables are deduced automatically from the expressions which are assigned to the variables. And these variables are local, they are not global. You can use global variables, but it's a bit more complicated. I'm not going to introduce that today because you need it only very rarely. You can also look at, yes?
Does this mean Julia can take care of the types automatically?
Yes.
Not that in the Fortran I need to declare the types.
Yes.
This is, Julia can take care of this automatically and without error, with no error.
Yes. So in Fortran you need to declare the types, but if you make an error in the types, the Fortran compiler will still tell you. And in modern languages, modern C++, so Python or Julia, the compiler can deduce the types. And you can still add type declarations, but this is mostly to catch errors. Julia will still deduce the type, and then if it doesn't match what you declare, there's an error, because probably something happened that you didn't expect to do.
In other language, maybe in Python, if you don't do it carefully, maybe it produces errors without any notification.
Yes, so this is the advantage of Julian, that it actually will help you produce errors. I mean, errors are useful because there's a disconnect because what you think the program is doing and what the program is actually doing. Now, earlier in this demonstration, I had two cases where I expected Julia to produce an error, and it helpfully didn't produce an error, right? When it converted 1.0 to 1, I don't like that, but apparently the Julia developers thought it's a good idea, or the character A was converted to the number 97 automatically. I don't like that, but this is how Julia is. But it doesn't go much further than that. So, for example, if you expect an array and there's just an integer, then the integer is not automatically converted to an array where all elements have the same value or something. So many of these things you have to do manually, and that means errors are caught. And this is one of the large advantages of Julia. And the other thing is, as I just mentioned, that the function is compiled for integers and for doubles. So depending on the argument types, you get a different compiled function. And for example, if you call this function here with x and y being integer, then a is integer. If you call it with x and y being double position, then a will be double position. And that means when the function is compiled, it deduces the types and creates the most efficient code for that. And that is something that in Python would not be possible. I don't want to diss Python here, right? It's just I'm comparing to Python here. There are many things wrong with Julia, but of course I won't expand on them today. Yes?
So, I mean, does that system, does it also automatically change types on the fly? Because, I mean, in your examples, you had A and it converted it to 97, I think it was.
Yes.
That automatically, this is what you just pointed out. And then just A, you defined A equals X times Y. Now, what type does it think A is now? It must be a number, yeah?
Here? No. Here, nothing, because it doesn't know about X, Y, and Z.
Right.
But if I call F with a particular type, then it can deduce a type for A.
Right.
And indeed, the type of A can change, and this is indeed one of the marginal performance problems that you can encounter. It's called a type instability. If A is first an integer and then a floating point numbers, then at runtime it can't allocate an integer register for it. Rather, it needs to what is called box the type that leads to memory allocations, and the code runs 10 or 100 times more slowly. And there's also a macro that I was actually about to show for how to find out. I showed you the code native. There's also a code typed where you see the types of all the expressions. That is now a different intermediate representation that is maybe easier, maybe more difficult to understand. This is how the code actually looks like after the compiler sees. So %1, %2, so x, y, and z are the variables, the arguments passed, %1, %2, %3 are the renamed variables that you have here, and molint and addInt are the particularly functions to which the multiplication addition is converted.
Right, okay, so you've been using A as a local variable and
yes.
Different things, and yet if you don't somehow clean it, then you can have this problem with type instability that can slow your code down. Is there a way of avoiding that? I mean, Maple, for example, will tell you it has an unassigned command, so you can individually deassign things.
Okay.
To reset everything, which is
yes. Great. So the trick here is to use small functions, because local variables come into existence at the beginning of a function. And even if it has a global variable, it becomes invisible. And then at the end of the function, A goes out of scope again. So if you have small functions, you don't have that problem. And even if you assign two different things, it's not quite clear whether the optimizer catches the case or not. Right? If you first say A equals 1 and later A equals whatever some character, then the compiler could notice that it's actually two distinct ranges where the variables are used. And at the later point, these variables are going to be split into two variables anyway, but I don't know whether it's caught or not. Anyway, this is with type information where the compiler deduced all the types. And there's also a thing called code warn type. This is maybe way too advanced, but since we talked about that, where it outlines in red all the performance problems. There's no performance problem, hence no red, but you get the idea.
What is a performance problem?
A performance, okay, well, I meant this type instability. If a variable has a particular type, is always int, the compiler can generate very efficient code. You get the same speed as in C, C++, Fortran. But if the compiler does not know ahead of time what type a variable has, that it needs to look it up at runtime, and then you get the same speed of Python, which is probably 10 times slower. So this is one of the main reasons. And we're going into way too much detail for an introduction to that. This will come up later. Don't worry if you don't understand that. Don't worry. And of course, there are tutorials, there are videos, there are beginner-friendly sections in the language documentation and so on that point it out. What I wanted to do here is just point out such macros that make it rather easy to look at the compiled code and get more information. Although as a beginner, right, all these magic letter combinations are not very useful, but it is there. Remember that, and maybe at a later point you can look at that. Yes?
So you mentioned that the functions are compiled when they're first called. If I want to, if I write some code and I want to execute it 1,000 times with different parameters, is there a way to compile it once?
Yes, yes.
Every single time.
Yes, there is. So there's a thing called pre-compilation, and I'm going to, it should happen automatically. So Julia has a cache, so if you pre-compile, so what you would do is you would write a module, and then it looks at the module and kind of calculates a checksum probably, and then it pre-compiles it and puts some, most any of the functions into a cache, and later on when it loads the module again and the checksum has not changed, then actually you get the pre-compiled code. That's particularly interesting if you run Julia on 1,000 computers at the same time, because if 1,000 computers, 1,000 nodes try to compile at the same time, that then it's just a waste of time. And pre-compiling helps there quite a bit. But this is now, this is, yeah, well.
Does Python do that as well?
Regular Python does not compile functions, so not. There are two versions. One is Cython. Cython is compiled. Sorry. Yes, Cython is compiled, and there's PyPy, and I don't know what PyPy does, whether it has a cache or not. I mean, they know about Julia, so they're probably doing something in that respect as well.
That would be an IR.
Pardon?
PyPy compiles to IR.
Yes, that is the same as Julia does, but the question is, does it have a cache where it compiles something and then remembers it?
Not really, I don't think so.
Okay. Yes, point for Julia. Sorry. Okay. Now, yes?
Sorry, a related question. So if it pre-compiles and then I want to use it in some totally different types, or will that truly just cause error? Or?
No, it will just compile. It's just the optimization. So if you pre-compile, you have to choose for what types you want to pre-compile. And if you then use it with more fancy types for which it's not pre-compiled, then it doesn't work. But usually you don't have an infinite number of types in a code, but just a finite number of types. And then pre-compiling stops. But of course you can, I think you could have an infinite number of types, and then at runtime you just use a finite subset of these and then pre-compiling would. Anyway, this is no way too complex. Okay, now I talked about types. There's a particular interesting constant called nothing. And the type of nothing is nothing. You know that if you have an 8-bit integer, it takes up 8 bits of storage. Each bit is 0 and 1, so it has 2 to the 8, that is 256 possible values. And you can have a Boolean. A Boolean has two possible values. The Boolean takes one bit. So 2 to the 1 is 2 for the two possible values. And now this nothing here is a particular constant that takes 0 bits of storage. But it's kind of a neutral element, so if you want. And with 0 bits of storage, you have 2 to the 0 equals one possible value, namely this nothing. And if your function that returns nothing, this is what it returns. It returns 0 bits. And if you want to make it explicit, there's this nothing. For example, if you output something to the screen, print screen hello, and ask. Now, of course, it prints something to the screen. But apart from that, it's a function, so it also returns something. And what it returns? Yes, it returns nothing. So the return value is lowercase nothing, and the type of the return value is this uppercase nothing. There's a distinction between lowercase nothing, which takes 0 big, and uppercase nothing. Uppercase nothing is a type that is something different. And something that is relevant if you do data analysis is how to handle missing values. And Julia has a particular constant called missing that you can put instead of something. For example, if you have an array, you write 1, 2, missing 4. Then you have a 4-element array, and the elements 1, 2, missing. So missing is actually something, but it's a constant that indicates that you don't have this particular number. And then if you add 1 plus missing, because you're missing information, it's missing again, and so on. But if you want to do statistics, you can take that into account, and then you would say you have a 4-element array, but the length of the array, if you take that into account, you really just have 3 measurements that you took, and the average is really just 3, whatever, 2 point something, and so on. And the important thing about missing is that it's built into the compiler and the language in such a way that it's very efficient. So here the array type was the deduced union of missing and int, and this is a very efficient internal storage. It doesn't lead to boxing or anything, and this was one of the major features of Julia 1.0. And handling missing values is really important if you do data science. Because all these data sets could be missing values. So yes?
If you have something with a bunch of missing values in your vector, will it allocate memory for it and just not initialize it?
Good question. Let's look at size of int 64 is 8. Size of missing, the type of missing is 0. And let's look at size of union here, 8. Not surprising. I think what it does, it allocates, here it claims it allocates 8 bytes for everything. I don't know how it's internally handled. Maybe there's a bit field that is stored separately, but it's stored very efficiently. And it does not allocate a pointer for every array element, so that would be the inefficient way. Okay. Now, today we went into a bit of a detour with how types are handled and other things and the internal representation. I see that some of you find it interesting. I also noticed that others of you did not say much during that part, and that probably means that it was too advanced for you. Sorry about this. Next Friday, that is Friday in 2 days from 1 to 3, you can bring your laptop and we will install Julia together. And after you install Julia, you can do many of these experiments yourself, and we will walk very slowly and make sure that also the beginners in this course understand everything that is going on. Conversely, if you're an expert in Julia, you can show up on Friday, but then probably just to help others install Julia on their laptop. That will be up to you. Thank you.